All right. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So we'll get started where everyone else does.
All right.
As far as earliest childhood memories, what are we getting into?
Ooh. Of anything? Or just like sport
anything.
Related?
Anything goes. So for me, it was, I want to say preschool. I was gluing my hands together in a closet, and then I kept getting in trouble for it.
Oh, man. Now that you mentioned that, I remember I was probably in third grade, second grade, and brought matches to school.
Okay.
And then
right, off to a good start.
Yep, good start. Me and my buddies, little kids, just thought we'd set some, just light the matches on fire.
So were you lighting the matches on fire? Were you starting other things on fire?
No, we were just lighting those matches up.
Okay.
Trying to make a fire
yeah.
with those, but nothing like... No property did or anything. We were just out in the playground.
Okay.
On recess.
And then, you were outside.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were just like in the middle of math class.
Oh,
like,
no,
I'm
no.
done with this.
No. We were in recess.
So what happened with the... Did the teachers say anything? Did you get in trouble?
Yeah, I got in as much trouble as you would probably give a third grader.
Okay.
Called home to mom.
Yeah.
Said, hey, your son's playing with matches at the school. And I don't remember if I got suspended or not. It was just kind of like,
yeah,
don't do that again.
So when you got home, were your parents one of disciplinary action? Did they want to talk to you about it? Was the silent treatment? What was going on?
They just wanted to know why.
Yeah.
And like, what about the matches or whatnot
yeah.
made me want to set them on fire? And I was like, I don't know.
It's fire, mom. It's cool. Yeah. I still remember like magnifying glasses, and
yeah.
when I figured out like I could make fire with those things, I was mm-hmm. like, "Ooh, let's go!"
Oh yeah,
this is great.
Definitely.
So other than matches and lighting things on fire in third mm-hmm. grade, were we into sports? Were we more so into school?
I've probably both. I would say like I can remember also like my parents getting me a Guinness Book of World Records for Christmas.
Let's go!
And then on the car rides to my grandparents' house. I'd just be sitting in the back reading it.
Yeah,
And just
for sure.
always was into nature, volcanoes as a kid, reading about those, learning about those, anything like earth related.
How'd you get into volcanoes as a kid? Did you go see volcanoes a lot as a child?
No, just like, I think...
Are there volcanoes in Canada?
There are, but not like close to where I grew up.
I didn't know if like the precipice of like, oh yeah, we're right next to a volcano.
Yeah.
But it was just, that's what you got into.
Yeah, and like I grew up in the 80s, so Mount St. Helens had like erupted before I was born, but shortly before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember seeing those like nature shows and stuff that kind of got me started down that road.
So invention idea. I've always had this, and I feel like I heard a little bit of this coming out recently, but you have a volcano,
mm-hmm.
you put like a dome over it, put a lot of plants and stuff in there to purify whatever air and gases, but then you just throw the garbage in there.
Mm,
and whatever gas, like the plants, will, like you get the right mix of...
Yeah.
They're not zebra plants. What's the ones that clean the oxygen really well?
Most plants?
Also, very true. Very true. my green thumb is not around today.
No, me neither.
But so volcanoes, anything outside? Was that because you were just outside a bunch as a child? Okay.
Yeah. So my parents, my dad was a pilot, so he was home less frequently.
Okay.
My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and I had an older brother, and it was basically like, here, Rob, go take Ryan to do something outside. So,
gotcha.
And that kind of gets into the sports thing, too, is when I was six... my brother had a dirt bike.
Mm-hmm.
He was a little bit older, so then I started getting into dirt bikes.
Nice.
Parents bought me my first dirt bike when I was like, and when I was six. Just
wow, that's young.
Yeah, see if I liked it. It was just like a little DS50, they call them, and rode around, loved it. And then they took me to like my first race when I was seven.
Wow.
And they were like, okay, do you want to try this? Like, do you want to try it? So we tried it. I was scared, but I loved it.
Yeah.
So then we did it a few more times, and then that. I think Christmas, a few years later, is when I got my first like real dirt bike.
So when you're dirt, like they gave you a dirt bike. If in Batavia where I grew up, there wasn't really anywhere to go unless like you had a bunch of land. Was there a lot of land by you? Were you just driving through like neighborhoods or?
No, we lived in a small town growing up for like my childhood years and
okay.
up to when I was 17.
Yeah.
And then there was like this place called the Deer Pit, which is just basically an old gravel pit of some sort, like, you know, off in the, you know, not near houses or anything.
Yeah.
And one of my brother's friends lived like next to it, and he was also like heavy into dirt bike racing at that point. So there was like a track there, you know, unsanctioned track, we'll call it, because it was also along an old railroad that they turned into like a public path.
Okay.
So we rode there, and then we would ride our bikes from like our house, which we backed onto a forest. So we just weave our way through the forest, get to the trail, get to the deer pit, and then that's where we rode.
Okay. So when you're getting into dirt biking, like when you first start, are you just like, hey, this is super fun, or I want to compete, or like what's going on when you're starting dirt biking?
Yeah, because I had seen my brother doing it
for
a couple of years, so I thought it was interesting. And then once I tried it, I liked it.
Yeah.
So my parents like, okay, like we'll get like, got you a bike.
Mm-hmm.
We'll race. But if you don't like to race all the time, like not a big deal. Like it wasn't pushed on me at all. And so when I started racing though, I loved it. And I was always like a little more tentative at first.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. And then it was probably not until I was like 10 or 12 and it kind of like stuck.
Does the high ever go away? Like when you're just, so I'd say the only things, I guess I've done four wheelers, I've done Sea-Doos or wave runners or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when you hammer it, like you're just, you're floating. And then when you stop, you're just buzzing. Does that ever stop when you're?
No,
no,
I don't think so. Cause like I raced until I was 19.
Yeah.
And no matter when I raced or even like first time doing a big jump or you're like, decide to like step it up and jump up higher or longer, you just you get those butterflies no matter what, and it's just a great feeling.
So how do you calm those nerves? I guess I when I mountain bike the little bit that I do, I still have those, but are you trying to breathe? Like what's going on there?
Try not to get too excited. Like obviously practicing a lot and getting it, you kind of like
probably a good idea,
you know how to handle it a little better. But it's also like it's breathing, you know, just nice controlled breathing, and just knowing that you've done it before. So
how big is the start to the race? Cause that's going to be the most time that people are all together. And it looks like that's when the most accidents happen. Like what's the start of the most races like?
Usually it's a 40 person gate.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So like, it's not always full, but you got up to 40 people. So 20 on each side of like a little gatehouse in the middle.
Yeah.
And that was always the most nervous time, because that was where most people got injured, seriously injured, just crashes and stuff. So it was always nerve-wracking, but that was always like one of my favorite parts.
Yeah.
Because for whatever reason, I was like good at starting. I guess my reaction time were good, but I just, you know, you get like heart pounding and then you just kind of go and then you're in it.
Yeah.
It's like the initial nervous adrenaline once a gate drops, so then it's like, okay, focus.
Okay.
Because like you got to not crash.
So I used to play motocross games with my buddy who actually did motocross and stuff like that. Is that the whole shot when you get out of the first turn, or what's the
whole shot's when you come out of the first turn first?
Okay.
And then you're you know, scot-free, we'll say.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it's the most chaotic time of the race. Mm-hmm. And it just goes for any sport, like car racing. Like if you watch F1, the starts can be bad.
Yeah.
Cycle racing.
Okay.
On the road courses, those can be, you know, same thing. So,
yeah. When you started racing, were you, I mean, it sounds like you weren't timid or afraid of it, but did you ever have to get past those kinds of things? Or
yeah, I would say the first year or two, maybe longer, you know, if my memory serves me correctly, it's probably a little longer, but I can remember starting and then just like gate would drop. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go. But then I wasn't trying to like get in there first. I was like, I'm just going to see what happens here. And then just kind of cruise up the back and then just pass people as I needed to there.
Okay.
And then it was just from doing it more and more, practicing and just getting good at the starts.
Yeah.
Then it becomes like you get nervous and butterflies, but you're not like scared anymore.
Are you always racing for first? Are you racing to get better at like such a young age? I assume first isn't like always the goal. Like it'd be nice, but how do you talk to yourself if you don't win and not just get like disappointed?
When I was a kid, like when I was young, I didn't even think about it.
Okay.
It was like just ride.
Yeah.
Just race. And like probably the first 2 or 3 years when I'm just figuring out how to actually do it.
Okay.
It's more just like, don't get hurt.
Okay.
At least that's what my parents said. I don't think I actually cared about that. Don't get hurt and, you know, have fun. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest thing, was have fun.
Yeah.
Because if parents were always like, if you weren't having fun, then we're not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
So that was good. They never like forced it on me, never pushed it. So yeah. It was always like,
that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I feel like the gymnastics parents or like soccer or tennis parents would probably need to hear that.
Yeah. And and my parents too, like I played every sport I could growing up.
Okay.
So they were like, we got to like probably, I don't know, I'd probably say I was like 13 or 14.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, how seriously do you want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, I want to race every weekend. But they're like, well, we can, like, you can stop doing other sports and focus on this one. Or you can keep playing all your summer sports and all the school sports and stuff. And we just do this for fun, but like still competitive. And I was like, oh, let's just do it for fun.
Okay.
So I was given the choice. And I just chose to, you know, still play volleyball, soccer, basketball, and race on the weekends in the summertime. Like, it was a April to October activity, but it like never interfered with school and it wasn't like the same season as school. So
gotcha. So what was the reason not to go like hardcore competitive with it?
I think I liked doing other things just as well. I wasn't hyper focused on this as a goal.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to do well.
Right.
And as best I could, given the amount of time I was going to spend on it.
Mm-hmm.
I practiced, you know, 2 or 3 times a week, but I wasn't going to race or practice 8 hours a day.
Gotcha.
That just wasn't who I was at that time. So
what does a practice look like? Do you try specific, not necessarily moves, but skills? And like, what are those skills that you're trying to work on?
So practice starts, just like literally just, you know, you have a little count in your head, do a start yourself and then just come back and do it over and over again. Don't even go on the track necessarily right away.
Okay.
Just practice the starts, get the timing down, the shifting down with the.
So what do you mean by this? Like you say 3, 2, 1, go, and then you have to like, what happens?
Yeah. So when you're by yourself, it's like a 3, 2, 1 go, or you kind of just like, I usually had a friend with me, so they would have just give me the old hand signal.
Okay.
And so it was a matter of like making sure your RPMs are up high. And then when you release the clutch to go, you don't just like dump the clutch, it's called, and like let the clutch out and just kind of like twist the throttle and like loop the bike or stall it out.
All right. So didn't really drive manual growing up. So you're going to have to help me out on this one. Mm-hmm. So when you're starting, you're in the gates.
Yep.
Your foot is on the clutch to start.
Fingers.
Fingers are on the clutch.
Yeah. And then your foot gear shifts down your left foot.
Okay.
Back brakes, right foot, front brake is right hand.
Okay.
So when I was racing, it was depending on the size of the bike, but usually start in first gear or second gear.
Okay.
How
do you get to that gear? You just, the bike's on and then you shift to it?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so bike's on, starts in neutral, pull the clutch, shift, press down for one,
okay,
and then the rest of the gears are up. And you got to come past neutral again to get to second.
Okay.
So that was kind of one of the things. Is like if you start in first and you're coming up to second, then you don't want to miss shift and go into neutral and kind of lose that split second of.
And you're shifting with your foot, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, foot. Sometimes with like the shin of your boot.
Okay.
There's like a buckle on there.
Yeah.
So you can kind of just click it up with the shin.
Gotcha.
Is what I started doing when I was older and a little better at it. And then when I got to the bigger bikes, I started in second gear.
Okay.
So what now they would call the 450cc bike was a 250cc two-stroke back then.
Okay.
And yeah, we would start in second just because it was more power.
Okay. So then looping would be if you hammered it too much, then it would just...
You'd kind of like if you just twist the throttle, like it's not fully wide open, but it's pretty wide open. So when you let the clutch out, if you're not paying attention, it's just going to go wheelie.
Gotcha.
And you'll see it if you look at those videos online and stuff. But practicing not to do that, keeping the weight over the front to keep the front end.
Yeah, I guess I just assumed, I was like, gate goes down, a little bit of gas.
Yeah.
But maybe a little bit more difficult. Okay. So we get past that. How do you improve turns? I wish I knew other terms other than turns and jumps. Mm-hmm. What's the, is it a rumble?
Whoops.
Whoops, that's what they're called. Okay,
yeah. Like the short ones that are like
when there's a lot of them. Like you see a bunch of people take different routes. Like what did you do?
I was more of a jumper through those.
Okay.
Depending on like how big they were, so like they varied. They could be like as high as this bench, or they could be like 3 or 4 feet high.
Oh.
So with those ones, it's like, it's always better to go faster
because
you can just skip across the top. But I was like never really committed to doing that because I didn't want to not do that and just totally eat it. So I would just, I would frequently do like doubles and triples through there.
Okay.
Depending on exactly how wide they were spaced.
Yeah.
But those were kind of the one thing that like the tracks where I grew up weren't very prominent.
Okay.
And they're very, they're technical features. So they're mostly in like supercross, which is like the indoor stuff. And motocross they can be, but they're more like gentle and gradual that you can either go fast and they don't really have a danger element to them.
Yeah.
Or you just jump them in some sort of like pattern.
So as far as training went, did you have any like outside, were you hitting the gym because you needed to be used to be on a bike for 20 minutes? What kind of training did you do other than being on the bike?
Yeah. So that would be my other sports.
Okay.
Mostly. So I played soccer in the summers as well. So that was my cardio.
Yeah.
And then during school, I played volleyball and basketball and track and field were my sports. So I felt like I was in pretty good shape cardio-wise. And then just raced, like riding, just go and ride for hours.
Really?
When I practice.
Man, I like on the wave runner after like 5 minutes, I'm tired.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot going on there. Yeah. How did you pick the other sports that you played?
Just trying them out.
Yeah.
The first sport I can remember playing was like T-ball.
Okay.
Because my brother played growing up. And then I played T-ball and softball in the small town I grew up in. And then I can very distinctly remember being like 12. And I was like getting called out for stealing bases. And they're like, you can't steal bases. And I basically went home and told my mom I'm not playing anymore if I can't steal bases.
At first I thought you were like taking the bases, but I was like, no, I know what stealing bases is.
And, you know, if I had stuck with it longer, I would have got to like hardball or whatever and been able to maybe steal bases then, or I don't know when they actually let you, but I was like, I'm done with that.
Yeah.
And then started playing soccer and liked it. So,
So obviously we have a lot of sports going on. Did that take up the entirety of everything, or did we go on vacations? Did we like school at all? What was going on there?
Yeah, I love school. Which is why, like, we'll maybe get into later, but I was in school until I was like 30 something.
Okay.
But yeah, I love school. There's certain things about school I didn't like. I didn't like math class, wasn't my favorite.
Okay.
English classes weren't my favorite. Mm-hmm. I liked the sciences. And what did they call them back in the day? Like, I guess they were arts and sciences would be the ones, but like, we had to do like cool outdoor stuff.
Okay.
Like outdoor ed classes.
Really?
So that was fun. But yeah, those were my favorite.
What was the education system like, and where'd you go to school?
For like elementary school and stuff? I grew up in Erin, Ontario, which is a small town near Guelph, which is where I spent my...
Guelph?
Yeah. G-U-E-L-P-H. And so we grew up there, and it was more... It was like small town school.
Okay.
And it was just like small classes.
Yeah. What would a small class be like?
15, 20.
Nice.
I think my grade 8 graduation was like 200 something people.
That's phenomenal. Our middle school is the same. No, I wouldn't say the same size.
Yeah.
But I think it was like 800 to 1,000 kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. My high school that I went to in Erin, I think the whole school was like 600 something.
Okay.
Three.
Nice. So do you feel that it was the education that you got that made it more enjoyable because the teachers could be more personable, or like what do you think?
I mean, I liked it. I don't know if it was, I wouldn't have been able to say back then it was because the teachers were more, you know, in detail with us, but I think it was just, I just liked it.
Okay.
Like I love to read. I would always read a lot back then.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just always thirsty for knowledge.
Okay.
And even if it was pointless, I just like to know, you know, if I had a question, I just went and found out.
Yeah.
Like I remember too, when it was like 1994, when we got like our first computer or something like that. It might have been, and it had came with like a, you know, a CD-ROM encyclopedia, which is like what's where all knowledge was at that point. And I can just remember like surfing through there, just looking up stuff. And
were your parents super into just like learning things, or where do you think your thirst for knowledge came from?
I don't know.
Were you wrong once and then you said never again?
No, that wasn't the case. I think I was just curious. I was just a curious kid. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what spurred that on, but I was just interested in knowing about stuff.
I feel like the school system for some kids ruins the thirst because they're just told that they have to learn and study for this test. And then once you've learned it, then like you no longer, and it's like, hey, like I like to learn things, but it doesn't seem like you guys care about me learning these things. It's just for the test.
Yeah.
With you doing all these sports and school and stuff like that, did your mom do all the cooking? Did you cook at all? Like, what did home food look like?
Mom was there doing most of the cooking, even though we did eat out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Still do, but that's how it was. We would, my dad was flying a lot.
Yeah.
So he'd bring food home when he would come home.
Yeah.
From trips. But yeah, my mom was doing most of the food stuff.
Like, he would bring food home from the trip itself, or just like on his drive home?
On his way home.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I went to Korea and brought some barbecue.
Yeah, right. No, it was Chinese food a lot.
Okay.
Which I like, so.
Mm. So was there a conversation around health, or was pretty much just you were hungry all the time since you were doing all the sports?
Yeah. That was pretty much it. Just I couldn't eat enough food to either gain weight or be like look unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
I was always a very lean person.
Yeah.
Always had trouble putting on weight. So
yeah. Till so now. When you say trouble putting on weight, did you want to put on weight? Like, you saw people that you're like, oh, I want to be like that guy.
Yeah. There's not because I wanted to be like anyone, I don't think.
Yeah.
Not that sticks out anyways, but I can remember when we were setting up my dirt bike for like, you know, you modify the suspension to like for the person who's riding it.
Okay.
And change the springs on the shocks and stuff, but I couldn't, they couldn't get one light enough for me. So I was on like a bike that was made for grown people.
Okay.
And I was, you know, that age, but it just, I wasn't heavy enough to like have a good suspension.
Okay. So it was too springy?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And it wouldn't, I was basically at the mercy of the bike instead of the bike responding to my body weight.
Okay. So then when you were like, hey, I'd like to put on some size, what was your go-to if you were trying?
That happened probably in grade 9 because we had it might have been grade 8 because my high school started grade 8.
Like
the grade 8s were included in the high school. So we had strength and conditioning class.
Nice.
And my teacher was cool, and we just did like very basic circuit training, like 3 days a week. But I remember I went from like maybe like 120 to like 140.
Wow.
In that semester.
20 pounds?
Like in that year, sorry, in that year. Okay.
I was about to say, let's go back and figure out what you were drinking there.
Hey, right.
So
but it was eating whatever I wanted and just trying and actually doing strength and conditioning. So actually lifting weights instead of nothing.
Like right. So was it like linear progression or more so just like five sets of like what was going on with the
linear progression? Just basically we would do like 8 to 10 reps.
Mm-hmm.
This week we say we do full body Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then just bump it up next week.
Bump it up. Such a great time in a child's life where you can just keep going up. Add 2.5, 5 pounds, and forever I will be adding weight in high school. Did you find like a new love for like lifting as a sport, or is that just something you did to get you better at other things?
It was to get better at other things, but that's where it all started, I would say.
Okay.
Like, where my desire for fitness and health kind of kicked in there. Or like consciously thinking about it.
Gotcha.
Being like, okay, these are decisions I have to make now to get what I want or do what I want to be able to do.
So. Okay. Was it more so like, I want to perform better, therefore I got to do this, and then... Was there like, oh, I should be doing plyometrics, or is if I can lift more, I can do more? Like, what was the...
Yeah, so it was put on weight was the basic tenet, and then it was okay. perform better, like in basketball and motocross and soccer yeah. and everything. So mm-hmm. I remember doing a lot of like jump programs for basketball.
Did you ever wear the heavy ankle shoes around or the?
No, not the just ankle weights.
Ankle weights, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
And I know there was like some jump shoes you could get back in the day that had like the toes were elevated mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah,
and I remember like wanting those.
Yeah.
My mom was like, no. She's like, I don't even know what these are for, but no.
So when you saw a jump program, was that on Google? Was it in a magazine? How were you getting
It was a magazine. It would have the one I used was Larry Hughes's from basketball. So it would have been in Slam magazine probably. Yeah. And I guess it was just advertising for it. And I was like, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
And then my mom actually let me, you know, spend the $20 or $50 or whatever it was. And it worked.
Yeah.
But looking back, you're like, yeah, of course it worked. Yeah. Like you just trained jumping for 8 weeks. What do you think is going to happen?
I got better at jumping. Yeah. So were you dunking? Like what did
no,
you?
No, I could get above the rim, but I couldn't like palm the ball yeah. to like actually dunk it. So
yeah. I remember it like freshman year of high school, like the big thing while warming up was like just trying to jump and touch the net. Mm. I was like, oh man, I'm awesome. Like yeah. I'm touching the net. And then I'd see people like touching the rim. I'm like, how do you do this? What yeah. what is this magic?
Yeah.
So high school is coming around. Do you have like a group of friends that you're hanging out with, or what's the situation there?
Yeah. All of them basically from my like sports teams and stuff.
Okay.
We all grew up together first in like our small elementary school.
Gotcha.
Then we went to the high school, kind of pulled in from different areas. So there's a few other schools that came there.
Okay.
And then, yeah, we played sports together, developed some new friendships there, and then, yeah, kept hanging out.
Mm-hmm. So with your family, you said vacations. Was that outside the country? Did you go to the U.S., mm-hmm. or where'd you guys head?
Yeah, most of the traveling we did when I was younger was for dirt biking.
Okay.
Like, we went to Florida a couple times pre-motocross.
Yeah.
But then it was, like, summer comes around, it's race season. Mm-hmm. We'd come to, like, we came to Red Bud in Indiana, Michigan, and then we went to Pennsylvania, New York State a few times.
Yeah.
And then went down to Florida like in March or something for like okay. my March break to get ready for the Canadian season.
Yeah.
And so that's basically where the vacations were. Yeah.
So while traveling with the family, I just recall being ungrateful and be like, traveling again, like we're gonna have to go look at a museum. What
yeah.
what was traveling for you, other than obviously the motocross stuff? Mm-hmm. Like that was super pumped up, but how did you enjoy the rest of the trip?
I liked it.
Yeah,
it was fun. Like the road trips were, you know, long.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, looking back, they seem very long when you're a kid, but now when you're an adult, you're like, no, that wasn't very long at all. Yeah. It was like 5 hours. Mm-hmm. I can drive 5 hours, no problem. And so road trips were fun. And like we usually, like my brother was there. He raced too until he like went off to school.
Okay.
So it was the four of us. And we had like friends who also raced
yeah.
that we knew from racing. Then we would meet up with them at certain races. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of more of like a family atmosphere there too. So
gotcha. As far as your parents go, do you feel like there was a pressure to do any things? I know you said they wanted you to have fun, but other than just like asking you to do things or asking if you had fun, how did they convey the things that they wanted you to do?
Like for racing, in racing terms?
Just like in general, because I feel like there's sometimes my parents would say things and it was either like really straightforward, but then I'd be like, do you do that? Like how did they get you to do things?
Told me.
Okay.
Like they would, you know, just tell me things I needed to do.
Okay.
And most of the time I'd do them. And if I didn't, then I would just find out a way not to do them okay. if I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty, I think me and my brother, we were probably pretty like obedient, I guess is for lack of a better word. But it was like never like, it was always, we were driven by being able to do the things we wanted to do
yeah.
to do the things we didn't want to do. So like
gotcha.
If we wanted to race,
yeah.
then we had to do some like chores and just okay. do well in school and not be
yeah.
an idiot.
Yeah.
So that's what we did.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like my parents.
Was there ever a time that you were an idiot so you didn't get to do some things?
I would say yes, but it wasn't like I was a big idiot.
Yeah. just medium-sized
matches. Just like a teenager, you know what I mean? And you know, they caught me smoking weed when I was younger, and they were like, okay, did you like it? And I was like, no. But they're like, if you do it again, you're not racing.
Okay.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah. So they didn't tell you like you were a bad person or try to shame you?
No.
It seems like a healthy thing to do.
Yeah. but I remember my dad did bring me home like a pamphlet or something on like cannabis from like somehow some publication, you know what I mean, about like the and I was like, okay, this is interesting, but you know.
Yeah. So the precipice of you smoking weed, was that just like everybody was doing it, you saw like in a show, or how did that come
around? Yeah, friends were doing it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try it, so.
Yeah.
It was funny, we were like at like a fun night, they called it, at elementary school. So like we would go, they have like games.
Wait, at elementary school, or it was at the
it was at an elementary school.
Gotcha.
And they had like games set up, and you know, people from around would come and just hang out and carnival games and like little fun things. And my brother came to pick me up.
Okay.
And I knew that was a bad sign. And I was like, he's like, yeah, mom found your stuff. And I was like, oh crap. So then went home, had the discussion.
Yeah.
And then that was fine from there. So
that sounds extremely healthy.
Yeah.
As far as like making decisions in your life, did you talk with your friends about it? Did you journal? How did you make big decisions as you were going through high school?
Talk to friends.
Okay.
Parents as well, depending on what it was. Like usually I would probably say I made most of the decisions by myself, because they weren't like life altering.
Right.
I didn't think at that point. So,
yeah.
Most of them were made with influence from friends and parents.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd probably say the biggest one would have been like, where are you going to go to school?
Okay.
Whereas like my parents never went to college.
Yeah.
So they didn't have really like any input on that per se, other than like you should go and figure out something you want to do, and then we'll go. So that was me deciding on where like programs and where I wanted to go and like where my friends were going.
Yeah.
So
is the goal or the conversation, hey, we should go to the US for schooling, or like what is the views when you're in Canada and next level schooling?
No real, like if you want to go play sports, they were like, you should go to the States.
Okay.
And I wasn't too like keen on like needing to play sports in college, which is probably why like I never really like picked a sport and just hammered it, because I didn't really care that much.
Yeah.
So I did go to school in Canada, like two undergrad degrees in Canada before I came to the States. So my parents really didn't have too much influence on me coming here.
Yeah. It was, so the 2 years, are you at school? Is it like a school in your town? How does that work?
I went to a school half an hour away from my...
Okay, so you still lived at home?
Not during school, no.
Oh, okay.
My parents were living there. I moved away to school. My parents were like, you can either go to school in Guelph, the university.
The name gets me. I'm going to have to get used to Guelph.
And live at home, or you can go to school at Laurier, which is the school I went to,
and
not live at home. I was like, see ya.
So what was it like living on your own? Did you know how to cook beforehand, or?
Yeah, I feel like I did. We had like a dining hall meeting or eating plan, so I didn't really need to, but like we had little snacks and stuff in the dorms, and I knew how to cook easy things that I needed. So I knew how to cook like chicken, mac and cheese for sure.
Yeah.
Like
the essentials.
Pasta. Yeah. The easy ones. And so, yeah, that's what I did. But it was most of the eating was done at the dining hall.
Did you put on a lot of weight since you weren't doing all those sports, or did you pick up rec, or what was going on?
I played intramural volleyball and ultimate frisbee.
Nice.
And then I went to was working out at a normal gym, like a Globo gym type situation. So still active. I put on maybe a little bit of weight, but like still nothing substantial.
Yeah. Nothing where you had to start buying new clothes or anything like that. Okay.
No. So I don't think I was pretty much, my heaviest I think was like 160 something pounds until like 5 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe 8 years ago.
Okay.
And then I started like working out here.
Yeah, for sure. two undergrads, is that something like you planned out, or how does the counselor, whoever, like show you the future? Like what did you see?
Yeah, so that just before I went away to school, there was this TV show Criminal Minds was out, and I was like, man, that is cool. So I want to become a criminal profiler. So that's when I was like, I'm going to do psychology. That's going to be the plan.
Yeah.
And then went to school and got like 3 years into it.
Okay.
I was like, I don't want to do that anymore.
Wait, why not? Was it because like the show was still on and you're like, nah.
No, and I thought because as I looked into it more and, you know, actually looked in it as a career and stuff, how I viewed it at the time was that, well, you're not really going to have much of like a family or personal life that's that you can talk about if you are actually like a criminal profiler.
Gotcha.
So I finished the degree, knew I wasn't going to do that, but then I was like, okay, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So I worked at a golf course after that.
Were you a golfer? Are you a golfer?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like to golf. And so I worked at a golf course on the grounds crew.
Yeah.
Really liked that a lot. And the guy who the superintendent was, like, you know, saw that I could work. And
you just, you like that nicely cut lawn, or like, what did you like so much about it?
Yeah, I liked taking care of the grass. And I liked how it looked.
Yeah.
Because it looked awesome. And, you know, there's a lot more science. There's a lot of science in it.
Break it down. What do we got?
Well, just taking care of the grass, like making sure it doesn't have diseases and making sure it's...
How can you tell if the grass has diseases?
Just by looking at it.
Really?
So if you're looking at it, if it's looks weird, it's probably got something wrong with it. But then you got to look at the soils and see what condition the soils are in. And then you just got to like learn and know about like what are the best conditions to grow grass.
All right.
And that's like... And that was really interesting to me. So I started like digging into that, like no pun intended, but digging into that. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to be a golf course superintendent and like spent a couple years doing that. And then I was just cruising through like.
What's your best golf course story?
What do you mean?
Wide spectrum. What do you got?
Just like, I don't know, man. There's some funny stories, but just like sleeping on a golf course. Cause like we would have like a like grounds crew like get togethers or whatnot. Okay. And they were basically like, well, you got to be at work at 5 a.m.
Okay.
So we would go out, you know, to a bar or whatever, wherever we were going. And then just like we pitched tents on like the little practice green that was right beside our shop.
Okay.
And just slept, like came back and slept there. Like
I
can remember my boss rolling in and just like knocking on all the tents, being like, get up. It's time to go.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to deal with like any animals that were coming on and causing disturbances, or mostly people? Or
Just like geese.
Okay.
Are like the biggest nuisance.
Are they called Canadian geese up there, or just geese?
Well, you think they'd be just geese, but they're Canadian geese.
Okay.
Because that's their actual name. But gotcha. We just call them like, look at those geese. So, yeah, those were nuisance. Anything that digs is a problem.
Okay.
But you usually take like just for some reason, if they don't have their habitat or whatnot, they just don't kind of stick around too much. But the geese do. They like to eat the grass.
And so what do you do for geese? Do you have to hire somebody with a dog or?
So when I was an assistant superintendent, I was responsible for like the weekends and just like other like fixing irrigation systems and stuff and more of the technical work.
Okay.
And so I would bring in my dog on the weekends.
Gotcha.
And he would just like run as much as he could and just chase geese.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And I just, you know, pick him up in the golf cart. We'd rip around somewhere else.
Yeah.
Find some geese and send them out. But if that didn't work, we also had basically a cap gun.
Okay.
That you had to have a permit for in Canada because it's like loud and obnoxious.
Okay.
But you basically just see wherever there's like a group of geese and you just fire it over top and it like pops over top and it's supposed to scare them and prevent them from coming back. But nothing can prevent geese from doing what they want. So,
so they kind of figure it out. So we're going into superintendent. Are you getting paid well for that? Or is it just something you're like, I really like to do this?
I was probably getting paid well.
Okay.
For it, looking back now on it, cause it was so long ago. That I'm like, man, if I just had stayed there, I would have been making so much more money. But it was fun. Like, it was a lot of work hours. I worked, you know, we did 12 days on, 2 days off. So basically every other weekend, you get off. And I was working like 5 a.m. to like dark when it was summertime.
That's a lot of work.
It was. And that's basically what was like, man, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not going to be like that forever.
Right.
But also... Golf courses stay open late. Like that is kind of like what it is.
Right.
So I just started cruising through the like University of Guelph at this point, see what programs were around in the geology department. Cause I was like, man, I really love geology still.
Okay. Back to the golf course. What are we looking at as far as like pesticides? What are we pouring all over the place?
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the sole purpose is like, to get the grass looking good, and it doesn't happen naturally.
So the pesticides are to get rid of just any opportunity of something like what, when I think of pesticides, I think of something that's going to kill insects. What else do they do?
Most of it, like the pesticides, are there. Yeah. To
get rid of pests,
well, but to get rid of stuff that's like going to hurt the grass.
Okay.
Cause like that's what people care about is like, yeah, how does it look? It's changing now, I would say, a little bit. I'm not obviously in tune with the industry anymore, yeah, but like we had pesticides, you had growth inhibitors that you put on the grass to slow it down from growing if you didn't want to like cut it all the time.
Okay.
And then just fertilizer, tons of fertilizer to get, yeah, it green, get it healthy. I would say we probably sprayed pesticides a couple times a year, maybe.
Really? That doesn't sound...
Yeah, like egregious. I remember, like we were spraying mostly like stuff to make the grass grow.
Okay.
Some of it was pesticides, but we tried not to.
Okay, that's cool. Was there ever a time where like when you started, like you could just spray, go out there in your sandals or whatever, and then at some point they added in like safety protocols or what was the?
No, like whenever I sprayed, it was always like suited up.
Okay.
Ventilator.
Wow.
Just like an air purifying respirator, yeah, yeah, like the 3M ones you wear, yeah, when you paint.
Okay.
And then obviously, you know, don't spray anybody.
Yeah.
So like we would do it off times in the morning.
Okay.
On the evening, on the weekends, or just like sometimes we'd be like, hey, we got to spray. So we need like a 2-hour head start.
Okay.
And then by that time, depending on the weather, mm-hmm, it was pretty much dried up and okay, you were good to go with terms of like walking on it and
so
golfing.
When it dries up, is it still like, is it not activated anymore or why, like what is drying up matter?
It just means like, cause it gets into the soil and the grass and the plant.
Okay.
So once it's like dry,
yeah,
you're not going to necessarily get it on you transfer wise.
Gotcha.
Or like on a golf ball and then okay, you pick up a golf ball, then you like put your hands in your mouth. So we don't want it to be wet.
Gotcha.
Similar, like if you have now, if you spray stuff on your lawn, it's yeah, like, it's good for pets in like 2 hours or once it dries type thing is okay, usually what it says.
So,
but if your dog's eating it, then it's a problem.
Right. Okay. And I was always interested, like if it dries, like I feel like it's still there though. Right.
Yeah.
But so, if it dries on the grass and then your dog eats the grass, wouldn't that still be bad?
Yeah. It's probably not great.
Okay. I was like, ah, all right.
Yeah.
So we're moving along. We're looking at the geology stuff. Mm-hmm. Guelph. We'll work on it.
Yeah.
We'll and you're like kind of liking this stuff. What pops up?
So there was a program called Earth Surface Science.
Okay.
Which was a combination of geology, physical geography, we called it, and also like geomorphology.
Geomorphology?
Yeah.
What's that?
So it means like how the landscape looks.
Okay.
And like all the features about it. And yeah, then like what caused that?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, what's the process that made that?
Yeah.
So that's the stuff I liked. And then just, yeah, did that. It was like a 3-year, because I had some like transfer stuff from my first one. So it took me like 3 years to do that.
Okay.
And then while that was going on, I had been like moved back from school to my parents' right, house. But then they had to go out west to Calgary for my dad's like last 5 years of his job.
Okay.
Because he had to retire at 60
yeah,
from flying. So they were like, do you want to stay here and live in this house or do you want us to sell it? And I was like, I would like to stay in this house.
Nice.
So I had a free place to live. And then
for your dad moving to Calgary, is that just the airport that he went to?
The company. Yeah. So he flew a private plane for an oil company, for the executives in the oil company.
Let's and go.
So at 60, they're like, you have to retire just for like health reasons right, and like, you know,
I feel like they're sticklers for pilots because if there's any issues, insurance is like, no.
Yeah. Well, and they just don't want, like, you got the CEO on the plane.
Right.
They don't want anything bad to happen. So he retired. He was
Was your dad ever able to say anything to you about like flights or anything like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was pretty like, it wasn't secretive.
Okay. Wasn't like Wolf on Wall Street.
No. No, it was, I mean, yeah, it wasn't like that. I don't think.
Not the stories you heard.
Yeah. But we were, when I was younger, you were allowed to fly on the plane if it wasn't like a business trip. So like if the plane was going to go get the interior redone,
yeah,
or like it needed some maintenance, then your family could fly.
That's cool.
But then they like stopped that later on. But I did get to fly once to Wichita, Kansas. They were redoing the interior of the plane. So I was like, went on a little trip there. It was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it was cool. But yeah, so that's why he had to go out west. Cause they were like, they transferred all the flight departments out there. Cause that's like in Canada, Alberta is like where the oil business is.
Yeah.
So he transferred out there and he was like, oh, we'll be back. Like they didn't plan on staying there. So I was like, okay, I'll live in the house until you're
I'll take care of this.
Yeah. So yeah, I went to school, lived in the house.
How rowdy did it get at the house?
We had some good nights because we had one of my buddies, my best friend from growing up, lived with me. And then, yeah, we just had all our friends who came back from school who were now like working or in grad school or whatnot.
Yeah.
We would just like hang out there every weekend. So
what was the party schedule as far as, is it every night we're drinking or how did you tame whatever that was?
Not every night, no. Because it was like, my buddy was working a normal job.
Yeah.
And I was in school, even though I was in college. I wasn't like I was when I was like the first time in college. So just on the weekends.
Okay.
Primarily. And then like if there was sporting events and stuff, we'd have some drinks, but it wasn't like,
What was your relationship with alcohol at that point?
It's like just for social events, drinking like weekends. Yeah. And that's pretty much how it is still now.
Yeah. So a healthy relationship with it.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I could probably do less of it, but
yeah. Yeah.
It's
not affecting life too much.
No, it doesn't get in the way of like my real life.
So. Yeah. As far as relationship with food, was it the same at that point as well?
Yeah. Yeah. I was pretty much eating whatever I wanted at that point and still like working out just at like a Globo gym.
Yeah. Back buys and tries or what was your
just like standard bodybuilding splits?
Let's go.
And not really even like I just did what I did because like my brother was a bodybuilder, like a real bodybuilder.
Okay.
When I was younger. And I just basically kind of learned from him what to do in that regard, and that's what I did.
Okay.
Because I didn't even like this was probably 2008 or 2009. So I wasn't familiar. CrossFit hadn't even crossed my brain. Yeah. Hasn't even crossed like most of people's eyes yet. Yeah. So it was just, that's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fine.
Yeah.
It seemed like it was good. It was doing its thing. And then I would still play like rec sports.
Okay.
Still played ultimate, still played volleyball when I could.
Nice.
Pick up basketball.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I was done dirt biking by college. So I didn't do that anymore.
So then we get to the whatever the geology thing is covering. Does that bring you to the U.S. or where are we going from there?
Yeah. So I finished near the end of that one. I wrote a paper for one class and the teacher teaching it was a grad student doing her PhD. And she was like, have you ever thought about grad school? And I was like, not really, like not even at all. So
no.
She's like, well, you should because you write well. I was like, okay. First I've ever heard that before. So then I started looking into it. And the professors who I was working with kind of studying rivers and beaches, I was like, hey, what do you guys like? I'm interested in grad school. What do I need to do type thing? And the one guy who'd studied rivers was retiring.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, can't work with you. And then one of the guys who was teaching us coastal processes, which is just beach erosion and stuff like that and how beaches change. He was also retired and he was just kind of teaching this class for fun. So I was like, okay, well, what are my options here? And he was like, well, I got a former student who's now a professor down in Texas.
Okay.
At Texas A&M. And I was like, Texas A&M studying beaches down there? I was like, okay. And then, so I put in contact with him and he was like, yeah, I actually have like a field research trip planned this summer. Do you want to come check it out and see if you'd like it or not?
Yeah.
And it was in Pensacola, Florida.
Okay.
And it was studying rip currents.
And what's the difference between a rip tide and a rip current?
Rip current is what, like rip tide it's not a real thing. It's called,
Got him.
But it's a rip current is like what it is. Gotcha. And it's just it's just a jet of water moving offshore.
Mm-hmm.
So it can seem like it's big, like wide, depending on, or narrow. So you can see them on photographs and you can see them if you're looking at the water and you know what to look at. So that's what he was studying. Because it's a big coastal hazard. Like lots of people drown.
I think there's like 12 this year.
Yeah.
That has happened since the hurricane or whatever hit California.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, is with rip currents on the West Coast or on the Pacific Coast are different than like the ones in the Gulf Coast or on the East Coast of the United States and Canada.
What makes them different?
On the West Coast, Pacific side, there's a lot more like underwater morphology or like bigger landforms under there. So they create bigger rip currents, like stronger.
When you say more morphology, is that like it's not just sand?
Yeah, it's not just sand. It's like not as gentle sloping as the Gulf Coast is or the Atlantic Coast. Atlantic Coast is like a little bit steeper even than the Gulf Coast, but the Gulf Coast is like flat for a while, relatively flat.
Mm-hmm.
So you get what they call mega rip currents on the West Coast because they can go up for like hundreds or thousands of meters into the ocean.
That's far.
So if you get caught in one of those, it's a big problem.
Yeah.
And storms make them, just rip currents in general,
more
prominent and more dangerous. So.
And so for the layman, you swim with the current, but out.
Yeah. So if it's like we'll call it your standard textbook rip current, you just either float with it.
Okay.
Or you swim sideways.
Okay.
Is the thinking there. Because if you just swim across it, you'll be out of it pretty quickly.
Okay.
Whereas like which is what happens when people panic.
Yeah.
They start swimming back towards the shore because they're going away from it, but you'll just never swim fast enough.
Yeah.
And you just get tired and then you drown.
Yeah. Fuck.
Whereas if like, I did some research on rip currents when I got to Texas A&M.
Okay.
And so what we did was we just like put some GPS dog collars on some flotation devices and just like set them in the rip current and just watch what happened. And like they would just go out and come back in. Like you would go out with the current and then the waves would bring you back on shore. So like literally if you just sat there, you would just do a big circle.
That's wild.
Yeah.
I feel like there should just be like a wide screen next to any beach. And it's just like, if you're going to go to the beach, please watch this.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
Yeah. And that's like what he was trying to do. He was working with a professor in Australia because they also have the same issue.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, there's this issue everywhere.
Yeah.
I would imagine, but it's more prominent because like Australia is a big beach
island. Yeah.
country. And so they were always working together to try to get people to like be educated about it.
Yeah.
So that was the purpose of that.
Okay, so you went down there and you're like, riptide, this is for me.
Mm-hmm. Rip current.
Rip current, this is for me.
Yeah.
Where are we going from there? Are we just staying in Texas? Like, what does undergraduate actually mean? Because like when you said, hey, you're really good at writing, why is that something that's important to be an undergraduate?
So
grad school
is like more research-based.
Okay.
In my field, it is for most, but it's basically do a science experiment, whatever it is, and then you write it up and try to publish it and get it to be used for knowledge. So that's the point of grad school, at least for me, was to like find something that is missing from a given body of literature, and then you fill that gap. Like, what don't we know?
Okay.
And that's what we were trying to do in grad school, is like find out things and then
be
like, hey, look, we found this out. And now this is something you could use for public safety.
That seems like enjoyable for school.
Yeah. It's like, it didn't feel like school.
Right.
It was because you got to choose all your classes.
Yeah.
Which ones you wanted. You got to do research every summer. And then that was it.
I'm going to start doing that for Adlin as soon as she understands what research is.
Yeah. Exactly. So like I got to do my research experiment and Galveston, Texas.
Okay.
Spent 2 weeks on the beach.
What was your experiment?
It was the GPS dog collars.
Gotcha.
And so they have like these structures along the beach called groins. And they're just like stone walls or rock walls or whatever it is to keep sediment from traveling down the beach.
Okay.
So that there is a beach.
Yeah.
but they also create these rip currents.
Ah.
So people will swim near them, even though they're not supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll fish near them or on them, and then they can fall in, and then they get washed out.
Gotcha. Because
it's like, picture like the surface,
mm-hmm.
like the beach surface. But then as you get to the groin, it like dips way down because you have water washing sediment out. So it gets deeper. Okay. So people can't touch there.
Yeah.
And it's faster moving, so they can get picked up.
Gotcha.
But what they didn't know was that, like, if you just sat in it,
yeah,
you would just come back. It's just like, you don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
So it was like, just don't panic. It's okay. Basically what we should be doing. So,
which is easier said than done.
It is, for sure.
In a life-threatening scenario.
Yeah, because even when, like, we had the GPS dog collars, and then we were like, hey, lifeguards, like, we're going to put life jackets on, but, like, can we just ride this rip current?
Yeah.
And they were like, we really don't want you to do that, but, yeah, like, okay.
It's for science.
Yeah, it's for science. And, like, there was a lifeguard who came out there with us. And so, yeah, we just, like, put our GPS dog collar on, sat down and floated out with it,
yeah,
and then just, like, circled back in.
Wow.
Ride it, come back in. And it was just like, well,
all, yeah, right. So have you been caught in a rip current sense?
No.
Okay.
But I do like to look for them when I'm at the beach.
Okay. So when you're looking for them, what are you looking for?
You're looking for areas that aren't wavy. What I like to say, and what my professor, my advisor would say, was like, when you go to a beach and you see a bunch of waves and it looks rough, but then you see a nice calm spot in between,
yeah,
you should probably just play in the rough waves.
Gotcha.
Because there's no rip current there.
Okay.
Usually.
All right.
Because it's the water's being like brought onshore with the waves, mm-hmm, not taken out through the current.
That so makes sense.
Yeah. It's an easy little safety thing. It's harder to see.
Okay. Like,
you know, there's subtlety to it. But if it's obvious, then it's obvious.
Then it's pretty, yeah, aggressive. So
usually if it's like a calmer, flat area,
yeah,
no like bubbles and foam and stuff, then, mm, that's probably where like water is going offshore.
Gotcha. So after we're done studying groins, mm-hmm, what do we move on to?
Moved up to Illinois to University of Illinois to do rivers.
Okay.
So I hit the beaches, moved up here to study rivers, and that's
where, in Champaign?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was studying floodplain deposition. So not very like...
All right, hit me with some knowledge. What does that mean?
Just means like as rivers flood,
okay,
they bring sediment from wherever else, and, mm-hmm, they deposit it on the floodplain. So basically you end up like building up a floodplain and changing how the land looks.
Okay.
So I was trying to figure out exactly how much sediment was being deposited for given flood events.
So the flood events, they must be happening for like an extended period of time. Do they, and they're just consistently changing floodplains, and, mm-hmm, it's just not the same thing every time, or...
Yeah,
because everything's changing.
Yeah, like so rivers themselves move around.
Okay.
On like we'll say a long time scale. But then flood events happen within that, but they also like, we'll call them micro changes in topography by like depositing sediment here, eroding sediment here. So you kind of get like this fluctuating landscape within the floodplain.
Okay.
That in itself will change, but like on longer time scales than like, mm-hmm, you or I.
So why does that matter?
Good question. That's so what I was doing, it was part of a project for, it was called the Critical Zone Observatory. And it was this big, like, well-funded project where they were trying to look at kind of the top meter of soil,
okay,
for like agriculture purposes and like growing ecosystems and just how those evolve. Whereas like my little nugget of that was like, well, if we just put a bunch of sediment on top of that, how does that affect ecosystems and, mm-hmm, and growing vegetation and stuff? So that was where my little nugget was. And it was in the Midwest.
So the flood events are happening at like farms and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. I thought it was just like right next to a riverbed. There was some, okay, this is making more sense. Okay.
Yeah. So, well, where I was studying them was in, there's this place called Ellerton Park,
okay,
down in Monticello, Illinois, I think it was. And
yep, I'll trust you.
Yeah. Big mansion, like big, well-known, like hog farmer was this Ellerton guy. Okay. So they got like a big mansion. Now it's like a hotel down there, but there's got a sweet floodplain that's like a protected site. So no one's like messing with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a sense of what the landscape was like pre-farming.
Did you just say a sweet floodplain?
Yeah.
Like cool?
Like awesome floodplain.
Gotcha.
And my very like well-refined vocabulary.
Okay.
And so it was protected, so it's untouched. So you don't have people like modifying it.
Okay.
It's like pretty much natural since humans have been here.
Okay.
So that's why I was studying it there. And then every time it would flood, before it would flood, I could, you know, if there's a big storm or like before the spring floods,
mm-hmm.
I would go out there, put these little like artificial turf mats down, staple them in, like across this transect, this line from the river to the floodplain.
Okay.
Edge of the floodplain. And then the flood would happen. I'd go out there, take some cool pictures. And then once the water receded, I'd go there, collect all the sediment from these mats, weigh it, do a grain size analysis to see what size actual sediment was being deposited.
Okay.
And then, yeah, we just added those basically up and was like, okay, over these 2 years of deposition, here's like how much sediment was deposited.
How much is it flooding? Is it like only during the rainy season or what's going on?
Yeah, it's for here, it's primarily spring.
Okay.
When the snow melts and large like rain events.
Okay.
Because the channels like around here are pretty consistent, like at least down in central Illinois where most of them are like agricultural ditches.
Okay.
So they're stable,
mm-hmm.
and they're deeper than normal.
Okay.
Because they've been like dug out to gotcha. Drain all those which used to be swamps mm-hmm. back in the day. So, yeah, just flood events, basically.
So what did we learn from this sweet, sweet floodplain?
That stuff deposited.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's it. It was just like I can't remember the exact numbers because I haven't looked at it in so long.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was right. Like, you know, in, say, a year, 2 years, maybe have, like, at certain positions on the landscape, so, like, in the low areas, which is where water will sit,
mm-hmm.
you get, like, significant deposition on
okay.
each flood event, maybe like I want to say like maybe like a centimeter, which doesn't seem like much,
no.
but if it happens 10 times a year, then that's
each event yeah. a centimeter. So what would be the sediment? Does not sound like rich soil that we want hanging around. Like what is sediment?
So sediment is just like either clay size, sand size, or silt size particles.
Okay.
And it's just stuff that's left over. So like anything, sediment in the garden, like that's just the material.
Okay.
And the thing around central Illinois is that you do lose it, and it is nutrient rich.
Oh, okay.
So that's what, you know, that's why they care about it, is
okay.
like all this does get washed off farms.
Mm-hmm.
So then where does it go? Does it actually stay in the system, or is it just gone? So that's where like we did find that like, yeah, it does get deposited on floodplains, which is like obvious
mm-hmm.
at the same time. But then we were just quantifying like how much for this given area there was.
Okay.
So we do want, that's the thing. We do want the soil kept around,
mm-hmm.
Because it is nutrient rich.
Yeah.
And does provide us with a bunch of, you know,
okay.
crops.
So then after that, do we start looking for jobs or mm-hmm. what's the move?
Yep. So, once that was done, we started looking for jobs similar. Well, I was looking for jobs similar, like, you know, subject matter.
Okay.
And there's the Illinois State Geologic Survey is there. That's where they're based. And so they had a job posting for environmental site assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I applied for.
Okay.
And then my now wife, she had been working there already because she had come up from Texas.
Got her.
And, she had that job and she's like, you're not going to like it, but it's a job for now.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. So, you know, did it, got it, and I didn't like it. So
what was so unlikable about it?
I was really keen on doing field work a lot, like being outdoors.
Yeah.
And it was primarily office based.
Oh.
And I like Laura had told me that.
Right.
She's like, you're not going to like this, even though the job posting sounds cool. She's like, it's not.
They got you.
So yeah, I did it because I needed a job at that point. And then a year and a half of that is when I found the job up here.
Okay.
And then I moved up. We moved up here.
What did they tell you about the job up here?
That it was going to be long hours doing inspections. And they kept on. I remember them because I was like, yeah, it's cool. I'm going to be outside all day. That's fine.
Yeah.
But then they were like, just so you know, like 60 hours a week minimum.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's fine. Like, that's not what I'm worried about. So I remember them asking it a few times, being like, okay, so you're okay with long hours. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. If you're paying me, I'll work it. So
60 hours seems very light for what.
And that was where it started. Like, that was like, okay, you're going to work 6 10-hour days. I was like, okay, that's fine. But then it was like, you know, it felt like it was like 3 weeks in and they were like, okay, we got to go to 12-hour days.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, we got to go 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm. So was your first job, is that where I met you? Or yeah. Oh, really?
First job up here, yeah.
Oh, God, that's hilarious. Now, I was recalling what we may be talking about at some point, but I don't know if I wouldn't say the main person in the story, I don't know if we can still talk about it because I don't know if it's gone to trial or not. So
it has.
Oh, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've been keeping up on it.
Oh, you're in the loop there. So I guess we can talk about them. But when we first met, you were the enemy. Mm-hmm. You were environmental. You were going to slow down work.
Yeah.
So I was a laborer for the pipeline. Just had to lay pipe, just dig things up, and just put the pipe in the ground.
Yeah.
What was your first impression when you showed up and you saw a bunch of Neanderthals digging on the ground?
I mean, so because I was more geology focused, I never did like environmental science per se, but I was like, cool, let's dig some stuff. Like,
yeah.
I didn't have a problem with it. It was only just like having to enforce the rules was the issue. Cause like, I get it. We all get it. Work needs to get done.
Yeah.
And I knew I was the enemy, like you said. Yeah. So it was just like, sorry, but like it's got to happen this way,
right?
Or you got to stop doing this, stop doing that,
right?
But it was just like, I mean, it was literally and figuratively just an everyday battle,
yeah.
Because I had like your crew, and I had like four other crews that I had to like keep in check.
Yeah, it was a lot of different issues, but it was pretty much I wasn't on the side of like, hey, we need to do whatever possible like to get this thing going, but they'd be like, hey, here's the code if so and so is walking by or walking up, so we need to stop like just throwing the water just straight over and put it back in the bag, or hey, if he's coming by, like hopefully he doesn't check under the bag to see if you cut it or stuff like that.
Yeah.
How quickly did you catch on, or like what was going on there?
I would probably say like once like the weather was really bad there in June.
Yeah.
Cause I remember this very vividly because it, you know, was the bane of my existence for like 2 months was, I learned quickly cause it was my first like big long pipeline inspection job. So it was like making sure I knew the regulations and then making sure I knew what was happening and supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And then it was like, okay, what is not being done, or like, how are they skirting this? Cause like, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I caught everyone a few times in each thing. You know what I mean? Like you can only hide it for so long, especially when I'm there all day.
Oh, and it's obvious if the water's not clear coming out, or it is clear, like where is the sediment going?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was just like, it was just a constant battle to be like, okay. Especially like when I walked up to your crew, because I knew who was in charge. I was like, this is going to be something, and I'm going to have to just talk to him again.
What was the impression when you first met him? I already have forgotten his name, so you can say it if you want, but I have forgotten his name.
Oh, man. It's going to. I forget it right now, but it'll come to me.
Oh, a cipher. Gotcha.
And so I just knew from the instant that I met him that it was going to be an issue.
Yeah.
Because I do have a psychological background.
Yeah.
Like I'm not a therapist or anything, or right, a psychiatrist, but like I recognize certain character traits in people, and I'm like,
yeah,
all right, we're going to be combative. Like he's going to be combative from day one.
Yeah.
And you can just tell that by someone's tone of voice.
Right.
And it quickly was like, okay, every day I'm like, all right. One of my coworkers who was there kind of like watching things, like if I wasn't there and I was like, hey, cheating, go over to this other site because like I need you to watch them. And then I get a call or message, be like, hey, they're doing this. And I was like, okay,
They didn't seem to really ever want to talk to him. Jeremy was his brother.
Was like the the foreman. I mean, I can understand like why they wouldn't want to talk to him either.
Yeah.
So it was just like, I always knew there was going to be an issue when I walked up.
Yeah.
Whether or not it was like, because you had a good little distance for me to walk up, so you could be like, all right, he's driving up the road.
Right. And that definitely happened quite a few times.
Oh, it happens in each one.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's the little cat and mouse game that everyone plays.
Yeah.
So I wasn't surprised and I wasn't offended. I was just like, you guys are not doing smart things.
Yeah.
Here. And like, in the grand scheme of things, it's not like, it's only bad because there's rules to follow.
Yeah.
But it's not like, the grand scheme of things, like no one's like theoretically getting hurt or right. like not malicious in any way, but it's like, got to follow the rules.
Right. Well, and I think the biggest, you can correct me if I'm wrong, we were just pumping sediment into farmers' like land at some point. Yeah. I'm like this probably is not great.
Yeah. And like, and it's not ideal.
Yeah.
But it's also like, I understood that like, we were working in a farm field.
Yeah.
So like, why can't we just put this in the other farm field?
Yeah.
And it's like, I know, but like, that's not the rule.
Right.
And like, because of that area, especially, it was like, if it was flat, it wouldn't have been that much of an issue, right. but also we could have just been like, put it over here. Cool. Mm. But because it was like steep slopes to like other houses that people were not friendly to this pipeline going through anyways. No. So it was like, we got to like do what we can here so that it's not a complete like public relations disaster.
Mm. Yeah. I remember at the beginning, like you and him would get into it quite often. And then like, I tried to be like, hey, this is what Ryan said. Like, this isn't how we're supposed to build this like water and containment and stuff like that.
I was gonna say it boiled down to like trying to not do the easy thing that was going to cost more money.
Yeah.
Which they ended up having to do anyways.
Yes, every time.
It's never not happened where you're just not going to be like, oh, this magically worked.
Yeah.
And look, we're saving so much time. Mm-hmm. No, it's just like, you need to do this.
Yeah.
And if you just had it done it from day one, it would have been no issues.
Yeah.
And that's like, those were all lessons learned to me and like everyone else, I think, going forward on their other projects and like my other experiences were like, okay, listen, if you're digging in the soil in Illinois, you don't have the silt bags aren't going to work.
Right.
Because they don't filter out the smaller particles, the clay particles.
Yeah.
So you can put 10 filter bags on it. You can put 400 hay bales on it. It's not going to work.
Which we tried.
Yeah. So that's why you needed those like sediment flocculating systems, which every like certain counties will just be like, you need this and you need to have it like drawn up how you're going to use it because I guarantee you, you're going to need it.
Yeah.
So that's what I was like. That was a frustrating part for me because I was like, I know you guys don't want to do it, but like, just do this.
Yeah.
So, or it was just like, hey, let's get one of those log things and then just like pump it at like 4,000 gallons a minute and see if it works. And it's like, no, it doesn't work like that.
It's filling up. It's filling up. Get another bag on it.
Yeah.
It's like, we've been here for 5 minutes.
Yeah, right.
So when we first met, I found out that you played volleyball and be like, hey, like you should come sub with us or you should come play with us. Mm. And then you'd be like, okay, yeah, like I'll come over. And then like something would go wrong. And you're like, I got to stay and write reports.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I always had like grand ideas of being like able to go home and just do what I wanted for like a couple hours in the evening. But it was like, nope, you're going to stay here because like if you guys were done.
Yeah.
Someone else was working late because they were screwing up somewhere else.
Right.
So I was like, oh, hey, we're going to cut through this river at 8 p.m. And I was like, you know, you have to put it back together, right? Like right away. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's fine. So then it'd be like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And I'm sleeping almost on the right away being like, okay.
Yeah.
This is not a good plan. So it was just like, even my wife was like, I was like, I know you're not going to see me much. Like I'm coming home sleeping, getting up at like 4:30 or whatever it was and then driving out there. So. Yeah.
Well, and I thought my schedule was tough. And then they're like, okay, we're going to start at like 5 now, like all the time. And I was like, excuse me? Like I come home, I eat some food. I try to act nice or even attempt to work out with my wife.
Yeah.
And then I would go to bed and then do the same thing. It was like two, 3 months
yeah.
for us.
Yeah.
When did, I might have to bleep it out. I don't, when did you find out, about the foreman and,
well after our many, like, not altercations, but like
heated exchanges.
Yes. Heated exchanges. Cause like, it was, I don't remember exactly when. I think there was a day and they were like, oh yeah, the FBI's here or whatever. And I was like, I never saw that. So I don't know if it was true or not.
Yeah.
And, they were talking about it. And then I went back to the one job, like one morning at the trailer.
Yeah.
After they were talking about it at the meeting and they were like, oh yeah, like, you know, whatever. I don't know if you want to say exactly what happened, but,
I think we can say it. I'll probably bleep out his name. So yeah, we'll just, I'll remember to do that.
So he was, under suspicion for killing his wife.
Yeah.
Or his ex-wife at that point, cause she was had been missing.
Mm-hmm.
And the inspector, the pipeline inspectors were just like, oh yeah, did you hear about that? And I was like, no. Like, what are you talking about? They're like, oh, he's going to be arrested or whatever for like,
yeah,
the murder, like the death of his wife. And I was like, oh, I was like, so you guys were letting me interact with him by myself and you just didn't tell me? They're like, no, we thought you knew. And I was like, why would I have known?
This man in overalls is just furious at me all the time, smoking cigarettes. I've never seen him eat a thing.
Yeah. <no. laughs> So I was like, I'm just like, oh, that makes total sense. Like if you had the stress of that potentially hanging over you,
oh,
or in my head, I'm like, that would make me stressed out.
Yeah.
If you didn't do it, but then like come to find out he did do it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm like, man, like I dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
Cause like you hear,
I'm just some little shit coming up to him.
Right. Like there's always jokes about like environmental inspectors being like left on the pipeline, like back in the decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I could see that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. And it was like, and I was working with, his brother was his straw. Mm-hmm. Like the guy right underneath him is like, they shared a room every night and he's always like, no, like, I don't think he did it. Like I'd be able to tell. And it's just like, it's just wild, wild being around that stuff. So, after that job, were you like, were you lifting at that point?
No. So that was, we had moved up to, we lived in Wheaton at that point.
Yep.
And that was like in the summer of 2017.
Yeah.
Laura, we were looking for where to go, like where to work out and stuff. And I was like, I'm not going to have any time, I don't think.
Yeah.
So I was like, you find a spot, if you like it, I'll join for sure. And then she was like, oh, there's this CrossFit gym. I was like, oh, hell yeah. Because I had seen like the glory years of CrossFit, the Richard Froning years. And I knew I'd wanted to do it, but I had never been stationed far long enough to be like, find a gym and then figure out how to do it all. And I was like,
yeah,
I don't have the time for that right now. So then she found this place and was like, yeah, the owner's cool. It's not like an aggressive, like beat you up type CrossFit gym. It's like actually cares about your health and stuff. And I was like, okay, cool.
Weird.
Yeah. So then I, once that job ended, or I had enough time to actually do it, was in like 2018 in February, when I did their 6-week challenge here to get like onboarded basically. And then it's been that ever since. So
yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. What was your eating like when you were doing environmental? Like that had to just been
terrible.
Yeah.
So that was when I had mentioned earlier that I was my lightest. I've never got more than like 165 or whatever. Yeah. Until that little year.
Yeah.
Because I was eating, I brought my lunch, but it was like, that's one meal of like five I have to eat today.
Right.
Because
and
like,
you're walking so much. And it's not just like on flat, nice paved roads.
Yeah. No, it was crappy railway tie roads.
Yeah.
But it was good. And I was just like eating everything still.
Yeah.
Like I'd eat at home. I had like my protein shake, which I've been eating for years.
Mm.
Which is probably the healthiest thing I had the whole time. But then it was like my lunch was a sandwich.
Yeah.
And then it was like, okay, welding inspectors got like barbecues going every day. So I'd hit up them for food and just like drinking sugary coffees.
Yeah.
And then going to get food whenever I was like hungry. So I ended up getting up to like 185 of like not muscle 185.
Right.
And so once I started here, I was like, okay, I need to cut down. So
yeah. I remember we chatted on the phone and I was starting doing the coaching online and I would tell you to do something and then like you did it and then you saw the progress that I'd say you'd see, and I'd be like, I'm the best coach ever. This is, my God, I am going to be millions. People are just going to listen to me. They do what I say. Was it ever hard for you to just like follow along with like whatever like I said or like other things in your life in general on that end?
Yes and no. Like, it's not hard for me to do something. Like, I don't, but what I do not struggle with, but like food for me, like I like to go out to eat.
Yeah.
And that was, like I mentioned earlier, it's just like a product of how I grew up. Like,
right.
We ate out a lot.
Yeah.
Or we got food delivered or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And we traveled for motocross and stuff. So I always ate out restaurants and I just liked that.
Yeah.
So that was, that's been like, even continues on to this day. I'm like, I just like to eat out.
Yeah.
So now it's like making better decisions. Mm-hmm. And that's like what I need to just do consistently. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were doing. It's just like, just do this.
Yeah.
And then it'll be good for you.
Well, I almost wanted to just like merge the phone calls like with you, because you would meal prep all the time. You're like, hey, this is what I have brought in for this mm-hmm. and this, and like I'm gonna go out, and like I'm like, this is wonderful. This is wonderful.
Yeah.
As far as like the meal prep stuff went, it seemed like you had a couple go-to meals. Mm-hmm. Are those still your meals, or what's your go-to meal prep?
I would say we've been meal prepping less lately, which is
I feel like there's a cycle that everyone goes through, and it's like hard macros, we're hitting whatever weight, either up or down, and then it's like, this is nice, and then we just transform into like, oh, like life in general is okay to have.
Yeah. Yeah, so like, and that's kind of where I'm at right now, is that I meal prepped pretty like religiously.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, in my head, I'm like, okay, I know portion sizes and stuff, but I'm like, so I'll just eyeball it.
Yeah.
Which is like easier, and I'm pretty decent at it still, I would say. But it's like, it just gets me out of the routine of like having the meal.
Mm-hmm.
But my meals are still go-to are just like rice and meat of some sort and some veggies.
Yeah.
Or what I like to do. Still hit up my protein shakes in the morning. And then the dinner time is like, we started doing these meal prep services, I guess.
Okay.
Where it's like, right now, like I get Factor meals.
Okay.
I just started that again because I like them.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there are enough calories for you? That's always been my issue as far as like delivery stuff. It's just like, I remember when we first tried Blue Apron, I'm like, where's the rest of the food?
I know. Yes, it's not.
Okay.
If I was like trying to like gain a ton of weight or something, just like going on like a bulk cycle, it would not be enough.
Okay.
So it'd have to be augmented with like protein.
Yeah.
But for where I'm at right now, it's like, it's enough. I know what I'm getting, so that I can just get them elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were like, I'm going to get Factor meals for lunch and dinner, it's not going to be enough.
Okay.
For like what you want to spend on it.
Yeah.
You could spend enough on it to get what you need, but it's going to be like $20 a meal instead of like something way cheaper.
So. Okay. So at what point did you know that you wanted to buy the CrossFit gym?
Not until basically I was asked if I wanted to.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So like I had started in 2018.
Yeah.
2020. Was it 2020? It's probably 2020.
Well, I remember like all your numbers were going up. Like you were cutting for a little bit. Then you're like, oh, I'm going to put on some muscle, some size. We're doing some like
challenge.
A bunch of volume and stuff like this. Your numbers just kept skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I'm going to start coaching. I'm like, my Lord. It's like, so you really like this stuff.
Yeah, no, I do love it. And so I started coaching mostly because like the previous owner got sick during COVID. Like, it was post COVID. We were back in the gym.
Yeah.
But I think he got COVID, but it was like added on to like some autoimmune issues.
Yeah.
So kind of, it knocked him out a couple times a year regardless. Yeah. And so he was like down, and it was like, no one was going to coach.
Right.
And I was like, hey, I can get my CPR certification and coach if you want. So I did that, started coaching. Got my L1 in that November. So November 21, I think it was. November 20? November 20.
Because
it'll be 3 years this November.
Nice.
And I didn't need it at that point per se, because we weren't a CrossFit gym, but I wanted to do it anyways. And then coaching like all the time. And then it was 2022, last year, around midsummer, and I had been coaching and kind of like being like more of the driving force, organizational force behind here, because he had started to get, he had another job.
Yeah.
And he was done with coaching. And so he was like, hey, just so you know, like I'm thinking of selling the gym, but like I want to keep it in the family, so to speak. Right. He's like, I know you like it and can probably buy it. He's like, are you interested in buying it?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm interested. Yes. Let me like talk to Laura. And she wasn't really on board at first, because like just didn't want the responsibility.
Yeah.
And but like I wanted to keep everyone here together.
Yeah. I mean, generally you don't buy a gym, like a CrossFit gym, to make a boatload of money.
No. And that's it. Like I, yeah. If I had just been in the class going to school or whatever, and he was like, oh, do you want to buy it? I would have been like, no.
Yeah.
But because I have a full-time job, I can afford to not make a ton of money on it, because like I have another income that I'm living off of.
Yeah.
So that was the only reason that was going to happen with me. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we could have like got a bunch of people together in the pot and bought it.
Yeah.
But the price was right.
Yeah.
And as like, you know, he would say, and like people would say, it's like more of like a labor of love.
Okay.
Than it is like, I would like to grow it into something big and awesome,
yeah.
But like, it's not the primary driver. Like I'm not, I don't need it to survive, but I wanted it to survive so that the people here could still work out and stay as a community that we are.
Yeah.
And so I did, but it wasn't until like, he was like, oh, hey, I'm going to sell it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, cause we had like in our little group of friends from the gym, we always joked, we were like, oh yeah, like which one of us is buying the gym? Because it was like, we just kind of saw the writing on the wall and turned out it was me.
So after purchasing it,
yeah.
Did you take over programming, or like what does programming look like these days?
So I programmed a little bit, worked a little bit off his template that he did, because he did all his own programming. He was really good at it. But then how we programmed, I was like, I don't have the time to do it. Like I'll learn it as I go, but I don't have the time to like sink into it right now.
Yeah.
So we use Training Think Tank, programming, cause they do it very similar to how we were set up with like strength focused CrossFit type workout, but not like, hardcore like CrossFit.
Okay.
Like it's functional, like it's CrossFit, but it's not like CrossFit.com workouts.
Gotcha.
There's
where it could just be shoulder press one day for max, and then the next day is Murph.
Yeah. No, it's like a 10 week to 12 week cycles.
Yeah.
And like retests and stuff. Like so it's very
well, the constantly varied thing is tough, because when you add so much stuff in there, I mean you're gonna drop some stuff.
Yeah.
And then if you're constantly working on like all of the skills, like, okay, do I have to do handstand work all the time? Like, if so, there's just so much stuff to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's tough for a member to be like, hey, like I'm kind of good at like a lot of stuff, but when you do the cycles, you're working on something you can see that you're progressing on.
Yeah. And so that's nice. It's like, I like them because it's purposeful.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's hundreds of movements, things that you can do, but you're not going to do them all the time.
Yeah.
You just can't fit that many things into it. So you got to like periodize it. It's like, okay, this, you know, 10 weeks we're going to work on fitness, but we're also going to like work on squats and get that up, and then next one's going to be deadlifts, or it's going to be front squats, or it's going to be whatever. But that's like a thing that everyone who goes to this gym, who has been here I should say, wanted to like keep it as a stronger like focus. Like we're all going to get, you know, cardiovascularly fit, but we want to be strong as well. So and that's from what I've heard from like people who are close with other gyms and stuff, like we might be, we're on the upper end of the strength for
that's
a membership.
Nice.
And that's what we want.
Yeah.
So
as far as owning a gym versus how you thought it would be, what's the biggest like positive that you've gotten out of it?
Biggest positive is just kind of like for me keeping it together. I wouldn't have wanted to buy like a gym I didn't know.
Okay.
Cause I don't have those connections that I have here. So like, because I was coaching so much near the end of it or beginning of when I bought it, like just those relationships are the best. And like me and my wife, we aren't from here. So like, this is our like literal circle of community. So it's like everyone is awesome. So it's like, why would I, that's what, that's like the best part of it. So
that's awesome.
it's, you know, it's hard to keep everything like straight in terms of like owning a business, but it's also like not terribly complicated. Like you run a gym, you have classes, and it's like, just keep it going.
Yeah.
Is how I look at it. And like, I want to get better at stuff so that, you know, people can get better in here too. So it's like a personal professional growth that takes place that will like continues to take place through throughout everything. Because like, obviously I don't know everything. Nobody does. So it's like, just keep on getting better and like give people more value. So
yeah, I've talked to a lot of coaches because I used to sell the UR supplements. So I went to a bunch of gyms, and the biggest thing I saw was usually the coach or the owner of the gym, their health was deteriorating. Like they weren't lifting as often. They were coaching so many classes. How do you fend that off?
So that's basically like, I'm in the middle of that right now.
Okay.
Because
be nice to your coach. Be nice to the owner if you're listening to this.
Yes. It's because like I do have another job.
Yeah.
It's juggling. That's maybe the hardest thing would be the time management.
Okay.
And being able to get done what I want to get done personally for like, you know, fitness reasons.
Yeah.
So I've always been an afternoon worker outer.
Yeah.
Is where I like to be. But I'm realizing, and I have been realizing for a time now, that I need to work out in the morning. So like 5:30 in the morning class, 6:30 in the morning class goes, and I should work out right at 7:30.
Yeah.
So that I get it done, because I'll go home, start working, and then I'm like, oh yeah, I'll go back to the gym at like 3:30, work out before the 4:30 class if I'm coaching.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen like that. So it's like it's been a slow realization, but like one where I know I need to like change it up and be just get up here in the morning and work out. So, cause I still do like probably 50% of the coaching.
Okay.
Which isn't like too much when you like think about the four classes a day, but it's just one thing. Cause I used to work out at 4:30, 5:30. Yeah. So like, sometimes I'll work out with the 4:30, 5:30 class now, depending on like who's here.
Yeah.
And if they're very experienced, then they'll want me to work out too. Cause because we are also close, they all know that I don't work out as much anymore.
Yeah.
So like, they're like,
you're itching.
They're like, hey, come out and work out. So
yeah.
It's like, I have a lot of like activities going on in my life, but they're nothing that's like I don't have kids.
Yeah.
So it's not like, there's no excuse for me not to work out is basically what I'm saying.
Hey, I like that. So we'll wrap this up so you can still get some food in before. So what's your definition of health? Not necessarily the dictionary definition, but what is health to you?
Health is being able to do what you want to do when you want to do it. And do it to a level that makes you happy. Cause like we all need to be strong. We all need to have muscle. But being able to like hang out with your kids, go somewhere on vacation, eat what you want to eat and not have to worry about those, like, all the little things all the time.
Right.
That's health. So it's like fitness, like physical health, and then like emotional health.
Yeah.
Is kind of like that other pillar that needs to be taken care of. So if you aren't physically healthy, like if you can't go do the things you want to do, then that's a, that's holding you back. So that could be a problem.
For sure. And then what's something from your life that you think the people listening to the podcast would be able to take away as a benefit?
Ooh, something from my life. Just don't get so focused on one thing.
Okay.
I like to do a lot of things growing up and in my life. So I find it beneficial, and I hope other people do too, or would. Like, don't get caught up in the minutia of certain things. Like, just kind of enjoy.
Yeah.
Look at things from, like, 30,000 foot view when you can, most of the time. I know some things require you to, like, hone in and focus on stuff, but, like, don't. Just enjoy everything.
Yeah.
So, and get enjoyment out of everything. Like, just, something's bothering you, just say, hey, this is fun now.
Yeah.
So, that's how I look at it.
Hey, there we go. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.